You're listening to Surrounded by History, a podcast of the Blue Earth County Historical Society. Produced by Radio Mankato with your host, Historical Society Executive Director Jessica Potter. And now, Surrounded by History.
Hello and welcome to Surrounded by History. I'm your host, Jessica Potter, with the Blue Earth County Historical Society. Joining me today is Radio Mankato's Jeff Lang. Each week, this program explores the history all around us, the history in plain sight. In this segment of Surrounded by History, we will dig into the history, the stories behind one of our local landmarks. I'll give you a few hints, Jeff.
All right.
Okay. Flour mill. Prairie. Where the buffalo roam.
All right. I think I know where we're going.
Where are we heading?
The Stepman Mill.
That is correct. Except for I do have to make one little correction. It's actually American bison that are out at Minneopa State Park. But that's not what we note the song to go as. So that's why I had to use where the buffalo roam. So today we're going to explore the history of a local landmark of Stepman Mill, part of our beautiful Minneopa State Park. So let's jump in and be surrounded by history. So in the 1860s, a German immigrant set his sights on land overlooking the Minnesota River Valley, determined to build a wind-powered grist mill on the prairie. This structure, located within the boundaries of Minneopa State Park, dates to the early days of Blue Earth County. The history of the mill can be divided into three periods. The first phase covers its construction in 1862 to its final days of operation in 1890. The deterioration process lasted from 1890 to 1929, when the Stepman family donated the mill to the Blue Earth County Historical Society. And the final and current phase includes a period of conflict between the dream of bringing the mill back to its glory days and the reality that the money pot is never full enough. Hmm. Here is Lewis's story and the mill that is his legacy. Lewis Stepman was born in Germany in 1835 and arrived in New York in early 1854. So as a young man, he traveled from Germany to New York. He worked as a stone mason in Pennsylvania until 1857. Lewis had an itch to head west and ended up in Mankato, where he worked for a time. When hearing gold was discovered at Peaks Pike, the young and adventurous Lewis moved to Colorado in 1860 to try his luck. In 1862, Lewis returned to Mankato, where he helped build some water-powered grist mills. Those were along many of the Blue Earth County's rivers. After building a mill near what is today Dotson Foundry, he was eager to get out on his own. Taking his saved wages, he decided to build his own mill west of Mankato on a rise of land in South Bend Township that was exposed to the winds that swept up and down the Minnesota River Valley. In that spring of 1862, 12 to 15 water-powered mills in the county were damaged by spring flooding. Early season weather-related damage was par for the course for these windmills, or these water mills, excuse me. Mm-hmm. Since Stepman was a stonemason by trade and had some knowledge of the windmills of his native Germany, a stone windmill made sense to him. So in the summer of 1862, I want you to keep that date in mind.
Okay.
The arduous task of putting together his mill began. Lewis had recently worked with three other masons along in building that mill near Dotson Foundry. So he hired them to help him, and soon the walls began to rise. When they reached 10 feet tall, the work had to cease for the year due to lack of money. And what else happened in the summer of 1862?
The Dakota conflict.
Yep. So the U.S.-Dakota War happened in 1862. And as you can imagine, a mill on the prairie in southern Minnesota along the Minnesota River Valley was a prime target.
I would think so. Being out there alone would not be safe.
Right. Potential. Because nobody knew what was really going to happen. So work continued that next year with the help of his neighbor, Herman Hegley. Nearly everything used to build the mill came from Lewis's property, including the stone for the exterior walls, as well as the white oak and hard maple that was used for floors, rafting, shafts, and gears. Even though Lewis was small in stature and never weighed more than 112 pounds.
Oh, wow, little guy.
He had a giant work ethic. There was no sawed wood used, but rather he hewed it with a broad axe.
What's hewed it mean?
So you chip away. So you aren't sawing it. You're not sawing your planks of wood. You're kind of basically chipping them.
Chipping apart. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yep. The other tools he used to build Setman Mill. So I want you to be picturing that incredibly tall, wonderfully constructed mill that we have out at Minneapolis State Park. So he used a broad axe, a hammer, a chisel, and an auger.
Okay.
And wooden pins were used instead of nails.
Interesting.
Okay.
All right.
So I think about that construction and it's just mind-boggling.
Right.
But the fact that it's still standing.
And I mean, you guys had was the wooden nails or pins, I guess, been replaced then with actual nails or anything?
I am not sure on that question.
Okay. Because how is it still standing with wood nails to hold it in even? Interesting.
Yeah. So the size of this thing is just incredible in its own right. The circular walls reached a height of 32 feet. They were 2 feet thick at the bottom and 18 inches at the top.
Okay.
So a little bit smaller at the top, but then what it does is it angles up. The distance apart at the bottom, at the base, is 30 feet, and it tapers up to 20 feet at the top. So a little bit thinner, narrower walls and a little bit of a smaller gap, and that's how it makes that kind of a little bit more like a tower. As the walls grew higher, there with no scaffolding for lifting, Setman built an inclined roadway to the top of the wall from the northwest side of the building. 55 cords of stone were used to build the structure. The only parts of the mill that were not handmade were two large beveled cogwheels, metal rollers, and the grist stones, which were bought from St. Louis for $600.
Wow.
Think about $600 at that time.
Right?
Crazy. So the entire domed roof could be rotated so that the blades, so the domed roof is where the blades, would actually have been attached to.
Okay.
Okay. So the dome roof could rotate so the blades could face into the ever-changing wind. To accomplish this, the roof sat on metal rollers, and a large triangular wooden frame on the opposite side of the blades was used to turn the roof. So the forearms, that's what it's called, when you think of the windmill, arms, they were 35 feet long and they were covered with a sailcloth. The speed of the wind dictated how much cloth the miller used on the arms. So they could pull it in or they could push it out, depends on how windy it was.
Okay.
If he covered all of them, it was known as a full sail. The hub to which the arms were attached was 2 feet square, making the total kind of, if you want to call it arm span, was 72 feet.
Dang.
I know. I know. Think about that. On the prairie.
That's a large object in the middle of the prairie.
Exactly.
It would definitely stood out. Now, because now there's a lot of trees around there.
Right.
But there
right.
wasn't at the time.
No, no. I just can't even imagine this. So the mill was already sitting at the highest point of land in the area. The roof itself was rising to 44 feet from the topsail over it. So needless to say, anybody that was in that area along the Minnesota River Valley had to be excited to find out when those blades were finally going to start moving.
Right.
You know, I just can't even imagine. So 1862, 1863, he was building the mill. The late summer of 1864, it was time to finally give the mill a test run.
It's a long time they put together a mill.
It is a long time.
A lot
time.
Of money to go into that.
It is. And we have to remember that he also had to take a pause during the U.S.-Dakota War. And unfortunately, 1864 has another war that is starting to rage out in the East.
That'd be the Civil War.
That would be the Civil War. So price of wheat was going up to $2.50 a bushel. So he was and he had no money, but he was so eager to get the mill going. He borrowed some money. And since he knew more about the construction side of things, he didn't really know the fine details of the milling process, he hired a miller to help him. So when that miller arrived, unfortunately, there was no wind for the or 5 weeks.
Oh.
So that miller left. So finally, on a Sunday morning in 1864, the breeze started to pick up. But Setman was a religious man and refused to work on the day of the Lord. His partner, Hegley, the neighbor, convinced him to let this one slide because if the Lord made the wind blow on Sunday, it must be to make flour. And thus the adventure began. Oh, and what an adventure. The first thing that happened was that the wheat clogged up in the millstones. Thinking that more speed would solve the issue, they put it in full sail. Remember, we talked about they could have little or a lot. Well, this is where things started to go really bad.
Oh, no.
As the wind increased and the mill started to run out of control, there was danger that the excess friction could cause a fire because this is something that, besides the millstones, you've got... The stone itself is rotating, but you also have dust, and this dust is very combustible.
Okay.
Okay, so there was a fear with everything kind of running out of control and the friction, it could cause a fire. So Setman quickly threw a piece of logging chain into the gear to try to stop it, only to see that logging chain break apart and send a chunk of metal through his hat. Oof. Goodness gracious, if he would have been just a little bit taller.
Good thing he's a little short guy.
Yeah, this would have been it, and this would have been the end of Setman's mill, and called Setman's Folly, probably more like it. Once they finally got the mill stopped, they had to make a few repairs, and they found that the actual problem was that the millstones were not dressed correctly. Okay, so here, I'm going to totally go geek on you.
Okay.
But it's a good time for a milling lesson. So the stones that grind the wheat into flour need to be worked on when they get shiny from grinding. Okay. So you think of anything and you rub it together a whole bunch, it's going to smooth out, right? So every once in a while, you need to go and you need to kind of beat them up a little bit, so to speak, and make it so that they can actually do grinding again.
Got you.
Okay. So usually it happens after about 3,000 bushels. Well, poor Setman, it happened right off the bat. So the process of dressing stones was that the top stone would be flipped over, and then you would be able to kind of start working on it. And the laborious task was striking the stone with a hammer to rough them up. So they would rough it up with a hammer, and it could take an experienced person up to 40 hours to dress a pair of stones. There were people who did this full time, and they would travel around to all the mills and say, hey, do you need your millstones dressed, because that's what I can do.
And they just sit there and beat on rocks.
And you beat on rocks.
Okay.
So this gets me, though. The saying, show your metal, which I've never heard, but this saying comes from people asking the millstone dresser to roll up his sleeves and show all the metal, M-E-T-A-L, embedded in his forearms from the hammer flaking off as proof of his experience. Once the stones were ready to grind, the miller needed to run... So basically, he would hit it with a hammer so many times that
they'd flake off and go into his skin.
Yes. And that would show who was the most experienced, is who was walking around with a bunch of metal in
their
arms.
Who wasn't wearing long sleeves.
Well, that probably went through the long sleeves. But if you imagine 40 hours banging on a millstone.
Incredible.
Okay. So then the next process was to run a full bushel of wheat through the stones so that the production could happen. But the flour that resulted from this first production had to be discarded because no matter how well they cleaned the stones after they dressed it, there would always be small remnants of stones or metal left over.
Oh.
So you always had to kind of like run a test run, and then you could, you know, start running them for good.
Gotcha.
Okay, so poor Setman. He has been so delayed, and now he has to have his millstones redressed because they weren't done right the first time. So once his grindstones were properly dressed and a better brake installed on the mill, he ran a fresh batch of wheat, which turned out some of excellent flour, and word spread quickly, and people started coming from many miles around with their wheat. People would wait while their wheat was turned into flour, sometimes staying overnight with the Setmans. If they had wheat on hand and a good wind, the mill could produce 150 bushels a day. But there were many days of no wind, and some days when the wind was too strong. There were days when the mill would be shut down for maintenance, and days when people simply could not get to the mill because of winter blizzards or muddy conditions in the spring. A rough guess is that good wind days with product on hand and the mill running smoothly would it be about 1 in 3 on average.
Oh, that's not that good.
Not that good.
That's what the benefit of the water is always running.
Yep, that's true. So in a little bit more about Settman, in 1866, he married Augusta Miller and bought out his partner Hegley, who was his neighbor. He then sold a share of his business to his father-in-law, Martin Miller, and his wife's brother, Charles Miller, became the sole agent to sell the flour. So they would produce it, and they would grind it, and then they would sell it.
Okay.
In 1868, Louis and Augusta's first child, Herman, was born. Louis was 33 and Augusta 17.
Oh, okay.
By 1890, the couple had 13 children, losing 4 in infancy.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So it ended up being quite a big family. So 1864 is what we were just on. We took a little sidetrack. So Settman, he got his mill up and running. He got married 2 years later. And then they started to really work the property and things like that. But unfortunately, in 1873, lightning struck 2 of the mill's arms, but they were soon replaced. At that time, Settman may have realized that being a miller was not enough to support a growing family. He started grazing some sheep on his land and tried a little farming. In the summer of 1880, a tornado carried away 2 of the mill arms. By this time, Hubbard Milling Company in Mankato, which we've talked about before, had been built and was using this new roller mill technology. So Settman was losing business to Progress. The mill continued to operate with just 2 arms, grinding corn as feed for animal farmers until 1890, when another storm came by and blew off the last 2 arms. Following the loss of all 4 of the arms, Settman's attention turned exclusively to farming, and year after year and decade after decade, the elements took their toll on the mill. When the roof developed large holes, the rain and snow worked its evil ways on the interior, and the floor is starting to give way. In 1913, the old warehouse next to the mill was torn down. Unfortunately, Lewis witnessed some of the decline of his mill before he died in 1914, and his wife Augusta followed him in 1918. By 1920, the mill was in danger of collapse. The Settman family, proud of the legacy of the mill and realizing that they did not have the resources to repair it, decided the best route would be to donate it to the Blue Earth County Historical Society. On May 11th, 1929, it was deeded over with 1 24/100 acres. Try to say that one fast. In 1931, just a couple of years later, the mill was deeded to the state of Minnesota, and Thomas Hughes, the secretary of the Minneopa State Park Commission, paid $130 to Bruno Hannell for doors, windows, frames, screens, hardware, and paint. This included 20 man hours of labor at 50 cents an hour. Good pay back in 1931.
I guess so.
In 1932, the state put in new floors and steps, but omitted to replace the 2nd and 5th floors. They just left those 2 floors out. In 1972, the roof was reshingled and new doors and windows were put in. The granary and warehouse that was the Settman's original home was rebuilt in 1974. So an interesting little thing is prior to 1989, the mill, during this whole time when there's a state park building, the mill was opened for people to go in and actually climb the stairs all the way to the top.
Oh, wow.
So when they took out floors, they were doing that really for an accessibility point. That's not how it would have been as an operation, but it would have been a way for people to access it. But in 1989, a crack developed on the outside wall and the floors looked a little shaky, and it was decided to permanently close the mill to visitors. So up until 1989, you could actually go in the mill.
Wow.
So no longer can you do that. In 1990, the roof, and since the roof from 1972 was leaking, it's pretty standard. Actually, that's quite a long time for a roof to try to hold out.
Right.
New doors and windows again were installed. Obviously, those are the biggest things that have to do with the long-term preservation of the building. And right now, it's been about 25 years since any major work has been done to the mill. Setman's Mill played an important role in the early development of this area. We are fortunate to be able to witness the grandeur of this local landmark over the 150 years since its completion and construction.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So we hope you enjoy today's program as we explore the rich history of a true local landmark, Setman Mill. All the information we share today comes from the archives of the Blue Earth County Historical Society, in particular an article written for the Historical Society by Tim Pulis. The Historical Society also features a working model of Setman Mill for visitors to come and see the details of mill operation. So you can see some of those floors that were actually quite close together.
All right.
So we thank you very much for joining us today. Until next time, we hope you see the history that surrounds you.
You've been listening to Surrounded by History, a podcast from the Blue Earth County Historical Society, produced by Radio Mankato. For more information on this and other topics, visit BlueEarthCountyHistory.com or stop by the Blue Earth County History Center at 424 Warren Street in Mankato. Thanks for listening to Surrounded by History.